All right, let's get back into it. Before I relieve you of your suspense, I want to address a question that could easily be raised in connection with net investment. I was demonstrating how net investment implies an aggregate economy-wide profit, and I was using as examples of net investment longer-lived equipment, construction projects, and so on. But you could very reasonably have the question, okay, maybe you can see how this explains an economy-wide aggregate profit, but how can it explain better profits in the grocery business? How could net investment going on in the economy as a whole help to explain profits being earned in all the different branches of industry where there wasn't any particular net investment occurring? So let me briefly deal with that. Let's imagine that we were in an economy that was where the average rate of profit was zero. There are some firms that make profits, but there are other firms that have equivalent losses. That's our initial state of affairs. There's no economy-wide aggregate profit. There's no positive average rate of profit. It's zero. All right, what would be the effect if the firms in all of these various industries that are just getting by, some of them are losing, some of them aren't making very much, suppose they start to think, well, the business we're in is just miserable. We need to get out of this. We need to withdraw at least some of our capital, get out. All right, what would be the effect if in the grocery business, for example, some chains simply closed some of their branches and they withdrew the capital that had supported those branches and they invested those funds in the channel tunnel or some equivalent of the channel tunnel. All right, what would be the effect on sales revenues in the grocery business? They could stay the same. But what would be happening to the costs deducted from those sales revenues as the result of the withdrawal of capital from the grocery business to help finance the construction project? Their costs would be less. They'd be making less productive expenditure in the grocery business. The sales revenues would be the same. The productive expenditure there would be less. The cost there would be less. The productive expenditure would now be taking place in some construction project. And so long until the project got onto the market, there's no cost. And when it does get onto the market, there's only depreciation cost. So this is how you would have profit throughout the economy. As the result of the withdrawal of capital from loss-making or modest profit areas and the shifting of it into more time-consuming processes of production. The sales revenues would be the same, but the costs would be less. And you would not have equivalent costs showing up where the process of production was being lengthened. So I don't want to go further into this at this point because I do want to get to explain resolve your suspense and explain how it is how we can have sales revenues exceeding productive expenditure and thus profits with no tendency for the rate to fall. But you had a question, Mr. Barton?
You had said moderate profit. Is there a standard that dictates what the percentage of what moderate profit is?
Okay.
And the reason I ask the question is because to me, it feels like as long as I'm making a profit and it is comfortable to me, whether that be 1% or the 20%, as long as I feel that I'm making one an impact in the business that I'm in,
yeah,
I'm satisfying my customers' wants, needs, and desires. Then yeah, I would probably stay. So, is there a standard that moderate is?
Right, is there a standard? What is a moderate profit? I don't think there's any fixed standard for all time. It will tend to change in different circumstances. If you're in an economy which for a long period of time, the going average rate of profit is 10%, then certainly a rate of profit of 2%, 3%, or 4% would be just a moderate profit. You might be in an economy in which the going average rate of profit was 5%. In that case, a moderate rate of profit would be lower than in the 10% economy. But there is no fixed standard for all time in all places, as far as I could see. Okay, so let's turn now to what can explain an excess of sales revenues over productive expenditure. If we have that, we will have also an explanation of an excess of sales revenues over costs equal to productive expenditure. The cost could get all the way up to productive expenditure, but if we can explain sales revenues greater than productive expenditure, we've still got an explanation of profit. So what can do the job? Well, I have an answer, and the answer is what I call net consumption. Net consumption. And I explain immediately, i.e., consumption in excess of the wage payments by business. Net consumption is consumption over and above the payment of wages by business. And where, who is responsible for this consumption? Well, essentially, it's the personal consumption of the businessmen and capitalists themselves. Typically, their consumption is ignored. It's not in a modern economy, it's not nearly as large as the consumption of the wage and salary earners, but it's still there, it's still something. And I'm going to try to show that this net consumption, consumption by businessmen and capitalists, which is financed by dividend payments, in the case of corporations, and draw payments in the case of partnerships and sole proprietorships. The partners and proprietors can simply draw funds out of their own firms, and they consume them themselves. And also, it can be financed in part out of the receipt of interest payments. Now, our procedure has been to include interest along with profit, and we will continue to do that. But we can recognize that interest payments are made and that they are a source of consumption to those who receive them. And that consumption will help to explain how sales revenues can exceed costs by an amount sufficient to cover, to provide profit inclusive of interest. So let's proceed to doing that.
You said net consumption is consumption over and above.
The payment of wages by business. It's consumption in excess of wage payments. Right here in point two, I have it. Can you see it? You have trouble seeing it? Do you guys in the back have trouble? Pardon me?
Got it right there, too.
Yeah, point two. It's point
four,
two.
Three and a four.
Okay. Now, okay, let's turn to some of the indicated links. All right, here we are. We're out to explain how it's possible for there to be an excess of sales revenues over productive expenditure. And what I've got here in table 16.1, I have, it's called the components of the demand for factors of production and products. We're looking at the components of the demand for factors of production. That's productive expenditure. That's over on the left. And we have the demand for the products of business. That's sales revenues. So here we are looking at things from the perspective of productive expenditure, demand for factors of production by business. When business firms make productive expenditure, they're making a demand for factors of production, essentially capital goods and labor. So there's a demand for capital goods by business. Well, from the perspective of the sellers of those capital goods, that's sales revenue. And notice I say identity. Demand for capital goods equals demand for capital goods by identity. They're identically the same. what General Motors spends in buying steel sheet from U.S. Steel, U.S. Steel has as sales revenues. What any business spends in buying capital goods, what the Sit and Sleep spends in advertising in the Orange County Register, that's advertising revenue to the Orange County Register. What Carl's Jr. spends in paying its lighting and heating bill to Southern California Edison or whomever, that's sales revenue of Southern California Edison. So insofar as the demand for factors of production or productive expenditure is a demand for capital goods, it is simultaneously sales revenue by identity. And then we have the demand for labor by business. That's also part of productive expenditure. Well, that shows up in the wage earner's demand for consumers' goods. We're going to provisionally assume, to make our job as simple as possible, that the wage earners simply consume their entire wages. Okay, well, so far we have the problem productive expenditure is generating sales revenues just equal to itself. We want to get beyond that. There is a source of sales revenues, item three. This is the source of the excess. The excess of sales revenues, the excess of the demand for the products of business over and above its demand for factors of production. And that is the businessmen's and capitalists' demand for consumers' goods. Businessmen and capitalists also, to some extent, consume. They too have to eat. They have to live somewhere. Buy clothes and one thing and another. So to some extent, they are consumers. Now, the extent to which businessmen and capitalists are consumers, from the perspective of the economy as a whole, this is something that operates to make sales revenues exceed productive expenditure. And we'll immediately proceed to quantify this. So,
Professor, is this assuming that the wages earned by for labor or from the laborers are spent entirely on consumers' goods?
Initially, we'll assume that they're entirely spent on consumers' goods. And as I pointed out, that's actually consistent with them also doing some substantial amount of saving. To the extent that wage earners save and put their savings in savings banks, let's say, or life insurance policies, what do the savings banks and life insurance policies do with those savings?
They sell them.
For the most part.
They sell their money.
Pardon me?
They sell their money.
Well, what sorts of loans do they typically make? A savings bank, a savings and loan association?
Mortgage.
Home mortgages, right? Okay. They're financing the purchase of new homes. Well, what sort of good is a new home if we go by the definitions I've been developing? Are you purchasing it for the purpose of making a subsequent sale at a profit or not? If you're not, well, then what type of good is the new home?
Consumer.
It's a consumer's good. So here, this is an instance of savings financing the purchase of an expensive consumer's good. And the same would be true to the extent their savings financed automobile loans, major appliance loans. Now, then it's also true that to some extent, in present-day conditions at least, wage earners are doing some saving in a form that finances productive expenditure. There is some substantial amount of that. But even then, we don't go very far off the mark if we assume, if not that all of their wages are in and of themselves consumed, if we assume at least that they have a full counterpart in consumption. Why? Because to the extent that wage earners' savings are not financing home mortgages and installment loans, consumer installment loans, such purchases are being financed by funds in the possession of business firms. So if we allow for business financing of consumer loans, I think that pretty well offsets a wage earner saving that's going to finance productive expenditure. So we're not going to go far off the mark if we assume, at least provisionally and initially, that all wages show up in consumption. And then we can allow for cases where this may not be so.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Wright.
How do we deal with the reality of hoarding and the, I believe you used the term leakage?
Okay, I use the term leakage. That's not my term, but okay. Okay, all right, now, what about hoarding? We'll be able to deal with that, too. But let's just say whatever people have wanted to hoard, they now have sufficient hoards. You see, hoarding is never something that is unlimited. You want to have a certain degree of cash. You want to have liquidity to some extent. But once you've got it, you no longer have to go on increasing it indefinitely. We don't have people with an infinite desire to hoard. But we'll be able to deal in the course of our analysis with some additional increase in the demand for money for holding. All right, let's put numbers on things now. Let's say the demand for capital goods is 500 units of money. Each unit can be several tens of billions of dollars. We're just saving brain space, not having to use unnecessary zeros. Pardon me?
There's not much left.
Not much left, okay. So we're full to capacity as it is. So here we are. We have demand for capital goods, 500 under the heading of productive expenditure, but that same expenditure of 500 is also a demand for the products of business. It's 500 of sales revenues. This again is General Motors' demand for steel sheet is here, and U.S. Steel's receipts of that demand are here. So productive expenditure for capital goods is sales revenues, receipts from the sale of capital goods by identity. And then we have the payment of wages by business, which we're assuming is 300. And then the wage earners consume their wages, labor's demand for consumers' goods, that's 300. So so far, we're back to where we were, only we have numbers. We have 800 of sales revenues and 800 of productive expenditure. Well, now we come to the source of the excess of sales revenues over and above productive expenditure. That's the businessman's and capitalist demand for consumers' goods, which I assume is 200. So businessmen and capitalists, they personally consume 200. You might imagine we start off, business is in possession of 1,000 units of money. The money is in the hands of business firms. They have 1,000 units of money. They use 500 units of money to buy capital goods. Where do those 500 units of money end back up? End up back. Well, back in the possession of business firms, not necessarily the same ones that spent the money, but other business firms. Some will end up with more cash, others less cash. Business firms pay out 300 in paying wages. The wage earners spend the wages. Where does that money end up?
Back in the hands of business.
And business firms pay themselves, they pay their owners dividends. Partners and proprietors draw funds, interest payments are made, and that is the source of 200 of consumption, which again also comes back to business. All right, when we add everything up, what are total sales revenues in the economy?
1,000.
What is productive expenditure?
800.
Now, what would be the effect if all of productive expenditure were expensed as costs immediately, like selling, general, and administrative expenses? Suppose all productive expenditure were treated as selling, general, and administrative expenses. What would be costs?
800.
Well, what are sales revenues? 1,000. What's profit? 200. We've got a source of profit here over and above productive expenditure. So costs could equal productive expenditure. It's okay if costs got to equal productive expenditure. Even so, we still have profit. We have sales revenues greater than productive expenditure, and they're greater to the extent that the owners and creditors of business are themselves consumers. This is what we've been looking for, a source of sales revenues over and above productive expenditure that makes sales revenues greater than costs that would equal productive expenditure. And there's no tendency here for the rate of profit to decline. I'll get to you guys in just a second. Suppose we make an assumption as to the total dollar amount of capital invested. Suppose we assume, as we did before, that there's 2,000 monetary units of capital invested in the whole economy. we've got 200 of profit. What's the economy-wide average rate of profit? Yes?
10%.
Okay, now, is there any, if things continue this way, if year in and year out we were to continue to have the same numbers, then year in and year out, we'd have 1,000 of sales revenues, and year in and year out, we'd have 800 of costs and 200 of profit, and the rate of profit would be unchanged at 10%. There's no increase in money and spending. We don't have that factor operative, but we would have a permanent abiding source of profit showing no tendency to decline. And we could say that to this extent, the rate of profit is determined by the rate of net consumption. The amount of net consumption is 200. The rate of net consumption is the amount divided by the amount of capital invested, which we are assuming is 2,000. So here we are, we have 2,000 of capital, 200 of net investment. That's a 10% net consumption rate. I'm sorry, I said 200 of net investment, I meant 200 of net consumption. We have 2,000 of capital, 200 of net consumption. That's a 10% net consumption rate. The net consumption generates 200 of profit, and that gives us a 10% profit rate. The rate of profit is being governed here at 10% by the rate of net consumption, which is 10%. Yes, Mr. Chung.
Help me understand that why you separate or divide the labor demand for consumers' good versus a business main debt demand for consumers' good. I mean, I don't understand why you divide, you know.
Why do I separate them?
Yeah, why you separate
them. Okay, well, the payment of wages is sooner or later going to show up as a cost, right? The money that an owner takes from his own business, if you, let's say you own a little shop somewhere, and your arrangement is every week or every month, you draw a certain sum from your business to pay your personal expenses, will that withdrawal show up as a cost ever in your income statement? Have you ever seen an income statement?
No,
it's not a cost. It's not a productive expenditure. It's simply a transfer of money that you own in your business to you personally. So it's not a productive expenditure. It'll never show up as a cost. Similarly, when corporations pay dividends, have you ever seen an income statement that shows an item, dividend cost?
No.
No, the payment of a dividend is not a cost. It's not a productive expenditure. It, too, is a transfer of funds from the enterprise to its owners. So it's not a cost. But the expenditure of those funds is a source of sales revenues in the economy. And it helps, it makes it possible for sales revenues to exceed productive expenditure. You see, whatever is productively expended, that comes back as sales revenues. And the productive expenditure generates sales revenues equal to itself. And then over and above that, there's this source of excess, the businessman's and capitalist demand for consumers' goods, which makes sales revenues greater than productive expenditure. And thus sales revenues greater than costs equal to productive expenditure. Mr. Winchell.
So are we then to assume that the basic net profit in the economy as a whole is generated by businessmen and capitalists? The assumption here based on this that the economy kind of goes along on its own and then whatever the businessmen and capitalists buy or...
Am I saying that that profit is accounted for by the consumption of businessmen and capitalists? In certain circumstances, it could be. I don't say that it is in the actual world. It would be in an economy in which the quantity of money were frozen for an indefinitely long period of time, in which productive expenditure were at an unchanged magnitude for assets of the same kind of the same span of life. If productive expenditure were fixed and the distribution between assets of a shorter life and a longer life, if that were fixed, in that case, costs and productive expenditure would be equal. The only thing left to explain profit would be net consumption. But now, in the world in which we live, we have other factors. I would say net consumption is one factor, one major factor. But we also have another factor, and that factor is the increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending. And let me point out, this increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending is something that operates to perpetuate net investment without any tendency for the net investment component of profit to decline. Now, how is this? Well, we've established that if productive expenditure were fixed for any class of assets, like our computers with $1 million a year to buy new computers, we saw that in 3 years, depreciation would equal $1 million, right? Okay, but what if the expenditure for these computers were growing at some compound annual rate, say just 2% a year? So this year, we spend $1 million for computers. Next year, we spend $1,020,000, and the year after that, $1,040,000. And this were to keep going indefinitely. Would the depreciation, would the annual depreciation charges ever catch up to the productive expenditure for that class of assets of a given life?
No.
It wouldn't. Why wouldn't it?
Because that continues to grow, whereas depreciation is set at a certain time.
Well, the depreciation grows too, but the depreciation has always lagged. See, the depreciation that shows up this year reflects the expenditure of previous years. You could work this out. Let's say here we are. We've had 3 years of outlays for assets of the same life, and each of those 3 years of outlays is 2% greater than the year before. Okay? But now, when we're in the third year, what will the depreciation look like in the third year? You see, we'll be depreciating 3 years worth of assets. 3 years worth of assets. We'll be depreciating this year's assets, one third of the value of this year's assets, one third of the value of last year's assets, the purchase of assets last year, and one third from the purchase the year before last. Well, what are we adding up? We're adding up three components that are each going to be a few percent below what we're spending today. Today, we're spending whatever we spent in the base year times 1.02 to the third power. We're spending what we spent in the base year, I guess you'd have to say it's 1.02 to the second power. We spent the base year, then the next year is 1.02 times that, the third year is 1.02 times that again. So the expenditure this year is 1.02 to the second power. What would be the sum of the three depreciation quotas? Well, it would be one third just of 1.02, and one third of the base year, and then one third of 1.02 times the base year. And so now, if you divided that up, we have three components. Our outlay is 1 times 1.02 to the second. That's the current outlay. What would be the three elements of depreciation? Well, we have 1 over 3 plus 1.02 over 3 plus 1.02 squared over 3. And now, if we break this up into three equal components, we have 1 times 1.02 squared over 3. Now, which is larger? Doesn't this leave some positive difference? This is bigger than a third, isn't it? There's a positive difference here. And there's also a positive difference over here. We have 1 times 1.02 over 3.
Squared,
yes. Thank you. All right, 1 times 1.02 squared is 2% larger than just plain 1.02.
Right.
And when you divide it by 3, it's larger. Only in this last year, we have 1 times 1.02 squared over 3, only these two terms are equal. These two are equal, but these two components are greater.
Right.
Okay, and that means that we have net investment going on here. So, but what's responsible for this continuation of net investment?
Continued buying and depreciation.
Well, it's the continued growth in productive expenditure. So the growth in productive expenditure gives rise to a continuation of net investment, simply because the depreciation quotas are always geared to the lower productive expenditures of past years. Well, to put this all together, I would say that the rate of profit that we observe in the real world, the rate of profit can always be described as equal to the sum of two components. There is the amount of net consumption plus the amount of net investment. That will always equal the rate of profit. And let me get to a formula that I have for that. Hopefully we can get right back to where we were. Let me try to bring this up. I think it's on page 748, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Okay. We'll get there. Okay, here we are. We start with the fact, equation one, profits equals sales minus cost. Anyone have any problem with that? Hopefully not. Right now, two, we have profits equals sales minus productive expenditure plus productive expenditure minus costs. We're inserting productive expenditure as a negative and also as a positive term. Any problem with that? Can we do that? I think you can't object. If we subtract and add the same number, we don't affect an equation. Now, sales minus productive expenditure will equal net consumption. I haven't really shown you that yet. We have already shown that productive expenditure minus cost equals net investment. If it is the case that sales minus productive expenditure is net consumption, then what does total profit in the economy equal? Net consumption plus net investment. Net consumption plus net investment. Now, we can also express the rate of profit in terms of the net of a net consumption and net investment rate. And that is what I point out on page 750, two pages later. Right here in this paragraph, it follows that since the aggregate amount of profit is equal to the sum of net consumption plus net investment, that the average rate of profit in the economic system equals not only the previously described net consumption rate, but the sum of the net consumption rate plus the net investment rate. Now, how can we do this? Well, it's equivalent to this. Suppose we have a formula, A plus B over C. A is the amount of net consumption, B is the amount of net investment. And A and B equal the rate of profit. So the rate of profit is equal to A plus B, net consumption plus net investment, over capital invested. But isn't that also equal to A over the capital invested plus B over the capital invested? Doesn't A plus B over C equal A over C plus B over C?
Yes.
Okay, well that means the rate of profit in the economy can be conceptualized in terms of two components, the net consumption rate plus the net investment rate. The rate of profit will always be equal to the sum of the net consumption rate plus the net investment rate. And now, what is it that underlies the net investment rate? What keeps the net investment rate going possibly forever without any necessary tendency toward diminution? Well, the increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending. This is the main place that the increase in money and spending enters. It operates to keep net investment going without any tendency toward diminution. And we could incorporate that. I have a formulation of the rate of profit. Let me try to find that. Okay. Here, on page 773, I have a summary statement of the determinants of the rate of profit. I say, the rate of profit is determined by and equal to the sum of the rate of net consumption plus the rate of net investment. It can also be expressed as tending to equal, as an approximation, the sum of the rate of net consumption plus the rate of increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending. And the rate of increase in money and spending is what is ultimately giving rise to an undiminished rate of net investment. The rate of increase in money and spending operates mainly via establishing the net investment rate. So if you ask what's governing the rate of profit, well, I would say fundamentally two things are the rate of increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending, and the rate of net consumption. These are the factors governing the economy-wide average rate of profit. The economy-wide average rate of profit is governed fundamentally by the rate of net consumption and the rate of increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending. Now, that rate of increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending is what is operating to determine the rate of net investment. At any given time, in any given year, the rate of profit will always equal the sum of the rate of net consumption plus the rate of net investment. The rate of increase in the quantity of money is operating over a longer period of time. The rate of profit in any given year need not equal the rate of increase in money and spending, but it is tending to be influenced by that. Now, I don't know, is this clear or not? Please raise questions if you have problems, and now's the time to go into these matters.
It's very easy to get confused, I think, what the issue is.
Okay. Do you have any particular confusion?
Yeah, my life's a lot of confusion.
Pardon me? Your life is
no, I mean, there's no particular point of confusion. It's just that if you don't stay focused on every aspect of an equation or an example, you can very easily get to the wrong solution.
Okay, I'm sure that's true. Yeah. Okay, the basic thing is we want to explain how it is that sales revenues can regularly and consistently exceed costs in the economy as a whole. And we have seen the increase in money and spending is one thing that'll do it. And then in the absence of any increase in money and spending, we saw that on a temporary basis, or for a more or less prolonged time, we could have net investment. But in those conditions, the rate of profit would be tending to fall. What would explain a rate of profit that would not have to fall and could exist in the absence of any increase in money and spending, that's the rate of net consumption. Yes, Mr. Castillo.
What would you say is better for the economy, given a corporation was able to produce dividends, and they did one of two things: either give it out to the shareholders as dividends, and then would be spent on consumption goods, or reinvesting into its own company and using it as productive expenditure.
What's better from the point of view of the economy as a whole, and also? Almost always from the point of view of the corporation, too, I would say to invest the funds, to productively expend the funds. People will consume to some degree. Businessmen and capitalists will consume to some degree. They don't have to do anything to artificially boost it. Yes, Ms. Yang?
Or also the interplay that the a bank will charge a company for effective expenditure will in turn be paying for interest and dividends that the company pay to a company. It's a circular kind of.
All right, you're asking about the interest charged by a bank?
Yes.
Okay. Now, what about that interest?
Okay, when we talked about components of demand factors of production and products,
yeah.
The bank obviously make money by interest, by charging interest to
companies. Okay, the bank makes a profit on the interest it charges.
Right.
Okay.
So that's their demand for capital goods. I'm kind of confused here, so that's why I didn't
say. Okay. Pardon me?
Those would just be revenues.
Whose revenues are?
The bank.
Well, the bank, I see, in reality, the interest that banks take in, that is by no means a pure interest income. If you look at banks, for banks, interest occupies the same place that sales revenues do for a normal firm.
Right.
So the bank's gross revenues are the interest it takes in. And then the banks will typically have a wide array of costs that they deduct from their interest. So the actual net income of a bank is really a lot smaller than the interest it takes in.
Okay, so that excess interest will then be paid to companies that has money in their, let's say, CD account, whatever.
Well, now, the interest, banks pay interest, okay, and the interest that they're paying, whether to companies, it's part of the gross revenues of the companies, and then the companies may be paying interest to their bondholders. The interest payments to banks is a particularly complicated matter. So what is the perspective that you want to see there?
Well, basically, what is the excess money there? Banks already paying interest and the business are earning interest on behalf of having savings in their account.
Yeah.
Then would that be the excess money that they generate from for having the money in the bank?
It's difficult to identify precisely what the contribution of the banking system is in this. This is an especially complicated question.
Okay.
I think it would be easier if we leave that complication aside as long as we can and assume that whatever interest payments businesses are making are going to people like bondholders, note holders, and they're simply consuming out of it. No, I'm sorry, I can't give you a better answer on that technicality. Let's try to have as few financial intermediaries involved as we can. Okay, let me ask anything else. All right, now there can be some further sources of net consumption. The main sources, the overwhelmingly most important ones, are dividends, draw, and interest payments by business to their creditors. Yes, Mr.
Going Trump. Back to table 16.2,
yeah.
And by you separating the businessman and the capitalist demand for consumer goods,
yeah.
Versus other than the labor demand, yeah. For consumers,
yeah.
Then if based on that concept, then when you say that it's always better for the economy if employer pay less on labor while spending more on their own behalf.
When you say better for the economy,
I mean in terms of the total demand for product, for the product of the businesses, you know.
Well, the total demand for the product will be the same. Suppose business firms somehow could pay labor 200, and they, the owners and creditors would consume 300. Imagine that. Is that what you have in mind?
Well, actually, that I had in mind was that, say, for instance, in this diagram here, the labor demand for consumer goods is 300. But yeah. What if the business demand and capitalist demand for consumer good is 500. Okay, because that they obviously, you know, they are the owner and they have a lot of, you know, profit or capital on hand. So the more they spend, is almost like double or triple than the amount that a regular consumer spending. So if that's the case, then when you say that based on this division here, it's kind of like it's promote businessmen to spend more on their own behalf than regular consumer.
Are you saying that businessmen and capitalists spend more than wage earners?
Or? Yeah, based on this table here, the way I perceive it is that you're encouraging that businessmen. Because like someone asked before, is that is it good for the economy as a whole if businessmen and capitalists spend more, you know, withdraw the money from the...
If they consume more and productively expend less. You're asking, which is better for the economy as a whole, the higher or lower rate of net consumption? Is that your question? Anyone have any thoughts? Which would be better, a higher or lower rate of net consumption? From the point of view of the economy as a whole?
Lower.
I'm hearing lower. And anyone else for lower? Mr. Davis?
If the funds were regenerated back to what we talked about earlier.
Well, we'll assume that the funds are going to be regenerated one way or the other. Why would a lower rate of net consumption be more desirable?
That would imply a higher rate of net investment.
All right, for a while it might be a higher rate of net investment, but if we didn't have an increase in the quantity of money, then we could expect pretty much that ultimately costs will rise to productive expenditure and... See, what would happen to profit? Suppose we start off, here's profit, it's 200. Suppose we change the assumption and businessmen and capitalists become more future-oriented. They curtail their consumption, they cut it back to 100, and they increase productive expenditure to 900. All right, what should we expect to be the effect on the demand for labor and capital goods if businessmen and capitalists save more and consume less? The demand for labor and capital goods. There'll be a greater demand for capital goods and a greater demand for labor. We might imagine that the demand for labor is now 350 and the demand for capital goods 550. Okay, isn't that very good from the perspective of wage earners?
Right.
They're earning more money. And what about from the perspective of capital accumulation? If you think back to the discussion we had about what brings about capital accumulation.
60-40 diagram.
Yeah, the 60-40 diagram. Well, now, instead of having a 50-50 diagram, which is what's implied here, because after all, what is total consumption expenditure? If we take the consumption of all the parties, it's 500, right? So it's a five. It's like figure 14-4, 500-500. Well, now, if we have less net consumption, more saving and productive expenditure, we'll tend to have some economic progress. We'll have a greater relative production of capital goods. The demand will be 550 for capital goods, 450 for consumers' goods. So what will be the effect of that on our continuing ability to produce?
Increase.
We'll get into a progressing economy. So this would be very positive. But now, what would be the effect, ultimately, on the rate of profit? What's happened to the rate of net consumption if we're going to have a 100 amount of net consumption and we have the initial capital is 2,000, and now it may be even greater than 2,000, because there will be some net investment for a while. Where is the rate of profit going?
Yeah.
It's going to be lower. It will stabilize at a lower level. So the economy-wide average rate of profit will be lower, corresponding to the lower rate of net consumption. But what will be happening to the general state of prosperity and rate of progress?
Real wages will be higher.
Real wages will be higher, and everyone's real income will be more rapidly rising, including real profit incomes. Because if here we have a stationary economy, then every year the 200 of profit buys the same amount. Well, suppose we end up, we have 100 of profit, but the amount that it buys is increasing at a compound annual rate. Well, at some point, the 100 amount of profit will be greater in real terms than was the 200. Now, this brings out a significant implication, I think. It is that there are conditions in which the economy-wide average rate of profit and economic progress and prosperity can be inversely related. If we had an unchanged quantity of money, if we had a constant quantity of money, a constant volume of expenditure, in those circumstances, the economy-wide average rate of profit and economic progress and prosperity would be inversely related. Now, this doesn't mean the rate of profit would need to go on falling. It would just mean that if it stabilized at a lower level than at a higher level, that would be preferable. If it stabilizes at a level low enough to permit substantial continuing progress. Now notice though, to round out the picture a little more fully, suppose we get this lower rate of net consumption and it inaugurates a process of economic progress. All right, then what is happening to the production and supply of practically everything? It will go up, and now if we had a commodity money system, if we were on a gold standard, what could we expect also to be happening to the production of gold and thus the quantity of money? That should become greater, and what is the effect of that on sales revenues and net investment in terms of it? The sales revenues will be growing, net investment will be positive, and what's the effect of a growing quantity of money and volume of sales revenues on the nominal rate of profit? It's adding something back. So scenario is you have a high rate of net consumption and economic stagnation. You have a high rate of profit with economic stagnation. Then if the society becomes more future oriented and people want to save and productively expend more and consume less, then we get positive economic progress. And if the money is gold, there will then be also, instead of the quantity of money stagnating along with the production of everything else, the quantity of money will tend to grow somewhat, and that will add back something to the rate of profit. So you might imagine a scenario like this. We start in a primitive country where people are pretty range of the moment. They're not very future-oriented. Maybe they're worried about being attacked by a band of marauders or whatever, or the government is unstable, it periodically robs them. And so people are not saving and investing very much. They're living for the moment. They're consuming heavily. And the rate of profit is very high. What kind of rate of profit do you think they have in Afghanistan?
High.
I would think pretty huge. So who's going to save and invest to be wiped out by the neighborhood tribal chief? I don't think there's much provision for the future there. Well, suppose things could improve there culturally. Suppose the country could settle down. You didn't have to worry about marauders. The government became stable. And people started adopting a longer-term view of things. They came to regard themselves as capable of providing for their future, and they benefit by doing so. What would be the effect on the rate of net consumption in Afghanistan? It would drop pretty sharply.
Why would it drop?
Because people are using funds to build up their businesses. Yeah, they're saving and investing instead of consuming. What would be the effect on the economy of Afghanistan? It would improve. And the rate of profit in Afghanistan would be significantly lower, very considerably lower, but it wouldn't drop all the way to the lower rate of net consumption, because now the economy of Afghanistan could grow from year to year in real terms and also in monetary terms.
The start would be to build the businesses.
Yeah, they'd have some substantial capital investment and much more rapid economic development. So they would go down from the kind of rate of profit they have to the kind of rate of profit that prevails in the so-called first world, a lower rate, but one accompanied by some significant economic progress.
Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. Now, closely related to these questions, I'm sure is another one, which I hope to get to. Yeah, let's turn to this. This is the question, why businessmen and capitalists cannot arbitrarily increase the rate of net consumption and the rate of profit. I think I detected in some of the questions being raised some idea that business firms, if what I'm saying is true, wouldn't that mean that a business firm might be in a position to raise its own rate of profit, in effect, by having a big party? Would this be something that an individual firm someone might look at? Would it be advisable, do you think, if you accept these ideas, to go back to your company and say, boy, I learned something fascinating the other night. Why don't you quintuple the dividend or whatever? Let's really have a blast. We'll step up our rate of net consumption. And I've just heard that that's the path to our earning a higher rate of profit. But I want to tell you that that would be an erroneous inference. It doesn't apply at the level of an individual company. And we can illustrate just how and why not. Suppose in the whole economy we have, I have an example developed here. I'll have to jump to page, to figure 15.2. This is as complicated as the diagrams get. But here we are in the economy as a whole. I'm assuming we have a capital of 1,800. This is simply an elaboration of figures we've looked at before. Maybe I can make it a little bit better. Let's try 16.1. Okay, 16.1 will be closer to what you've seen. Here we are. We have capital goods and consumers' goods being produced. And we have 800 units of money being expended, 500 to buy the capital goods, 300 to pay the wages. The same monetary totals that we looked at a few minutes ago in table 16.2. All right, so what value of assets does that imply? Here we are. We have capital goods purchased for 500 and one L of labor paid 300, and they're producing, and the productive effort is divided 50-50 between capital goods and labor. What's the cost value of the capital goods produced?
400,
half of the 800. And the cost value of the consumer's goods produced?
400.
Okay, so that's where we get the cost value of the capital goods and the consumer's goods. Well, now suppose on top of this, business firms hold 1,000 of cash. So the total assets in the economy are 1,800. The cash and the physical assets add up to 1,800. Now, it's in this economy that we have 200 of net consumption, and the total capital is 1,800. So what's the net consumption rate? What's the net consumption rate if the amount is 200 and the amount of capital invested is 1,800? What's 200 divided by 1,800?
9.
1/9, right? 200 over 1,800 is 100 over 900. That's 1/9. So the economy-wide rate of net consumption and rate of profit is 11.19%. Okay.
Just review that one more time real quick.
Okay. Here we are. We have 400 in capital invested in the capital goods produced and 400 in the consumer's goods, right? And if we assume, in addition, that business has 1,000 of cash, well, then what is the total capital of business?
1,800.
Okay, it's 1,800. And that is what is worked out in 16.2. You see, here we are in 16.2. We're showing again the 1K of capital goods at a cost value of 400, 1C of consumers' goods at a cost value of 400. And business has 1,000 units of cash. So the total capital invested in the whole economy is 1,800, okay? and net consumption is 200. The rate of net consumption is 2 over 18. The rate of profit will be 2 over 18, too. And now let's zero in on one individual firm. And we want to see how will this relate to an individual firm. Our individual firm might be a super huge firm. Just think, how big is a firm? How big would a firm have to be to account for 0.5% of our economic system? I doubt if we have, if Microsoft is that big. I don't think it's 0.5%. But let's work with a firm that we'll assume represents 0.5% of the economic system. If the total capital of the whole economy is 1,800, how much capital would a firm have that represents 0.5%? What is, yes?
0.05.
90? Well, what's 1% of 1,800?
180.
Yes? 1% of 1,800 should be 18. So a half of 1% should be 9. Okay, so let's say, here we are. We have a firm that has a capital of 9. That's its initial capital. Now, if that firm is investing with an average degree of skill and efficiency, how much profit should it make? What's 0.5% of 200? 1% of 200?
Two.
1% of 200 is 2, and 0.5% is 1. Okay, so initially, our firm has a capital of 9. We've got a firm with a capital of 9, and it's making a profit of 10. Okay, it's making a profit of 10. This firm's profit is, its total capital is 0.5%. If you take 0.5% times 200 over 1,800, or times 200 rather, 0.5% times 200, and this is D4, times E4. D4 is 0.5%, E4 is 200. So the profit of this firm is 1, right? Okay, now, suppose this firm tried to use the net consumption theory on its own. You go back and you say, hey, look, we can double our profits by doubling our net consumption. Let's declare a dividend of 1, and instead of just consuming 1, as we have been, just consuming our profit, let's dip into our capital of 9 and consume 1 of the 9. So our firm will now consume 2 instead of just 1. The owners and creditors of our firm will get dividends and interest totaling 2, which they'll consume. Okay, how would that work out? This would have some tendency to increase profits in the economy as a whole. What would be the effect on the amount of economy-wide net consumption? If the owners and creditors of this firm, who had been consuming just 1, just their profit, are now consuming 2.
Increases by 1.
Okay, then it increases by 1. So instead of being 200, it's now 201. But what has happened to the capital of this firm? It's down by 1. It used to be 9. It used to be 9 out of 1,800. That gave it 0.5. Here's 9 out of 1,800. But now, in order to step up its consumption, its capital is 8 out of 1799. Well, the basis it has for earning profit is its capital. And if it employs its capital with the average degree of skill and efficiency, and granted, total economy-wide profit might now be 201, assume it went up immediately, how much profit would this firm make if its capital is no longer 9 over 1,800, but 8 over 1,799? Well, it ends up being 0.89. 0.89 is it's D6 times E6. Well, here's D6, And D6 is the result of this firm having 8 over 1799. Its capital, it reduces its capital by 8, by 1. It takes 1 off the 9 to step up its consumption. So its capital is now 8. Total capital in the economy is down by 1, but this firm's capital on a relative basis is down substantially. How big is its capital relative to what it used to be? If it's now 8 and it used to be 9, its capital is now diminished by 1/9. It's 8/9 of what it used to be. How much does it increase the overall total of profits in the economy, which it will now share in? By 1 over 200. See, the central point here is that if any one individual or firm were to attempt to boost the rate of profit by stepping up his own consumption, he'd have to lose, because he'd be reducing his own capital in much greater degree than he would be enlarging the economy's profits. So he would increase profits, all right, but he wouldn't get the additional profits. The additional profits would go to those businessmen and capitalists who had not increased their consumption, who had not stepped up their consumption. So the implication is that it can never pay an individual businessman or capitalist to try to manipulate the rate of net consumption. From the perspective of any individual businessman or capitalist, if he can invest a larger capital with the same degree of skill and efficiency that he invests a smaller capital, he should earn more profit by saving and investing. The increase in consumption by any individual businessman or capitalist, while it raises profits, it raises the profits of other businessmen and capitalists, not his profits. Mr. Taylor.
I apologize if this is a silly question, but what's the difference between your dialogue between businessmen and capitalists?
What's the difference?
Yeah,
I use the terms pretty much interchangeably.
The same.
Yeah, any businessman is a capitalist. All businessmen are capitalists.
Right.
There may be some capitalists who are not businessmen, but they're providing capital to the businessmen.
All businessmen are capitalists, but then on
pardon me?
All businessmen are capitalists, but otherwise all capitalists may not necessarily do business.
Right, but they're financing businessmen. They own capital, they provide it. Okay, now, so it does not pay to manipulate the rate of net consumption or to attempt to do it. Let's deal with some implications of that. The second point down here, implications for the gravitation of relative wealth and income. We've just seen that if some businessman or capitalist steps up his consumption at the expense of his capital, his profits will decline. Now, suppose we imagine for the moment that all the different businessmen were investing with the same degree of skill and efficiency. They're investing with the same degree of skill and efficiency, and the rate of profit they're earning is equal to the net consumption rate. They're all earning a rate of profit equal to the net consumption rate. What will be the effect if, and let's assume that the net consumption rate is 10% and the rate of profit is 10%, what will be the effect if there are some businessmen who are saving and investing half of their profits, half of the 10%, and consuming the other half? There are other businessmen who are consuming more than their profit. They're consuming, they have a personal net consumption rate of 15%. So we've got two categories of businessmen and capitalists. One has a net consumption rate of 5%, the other has a net consumption rate of 15%. They're both investing with the same degree of skill and efficiency, and they both are initially earning a 10% rate of profit. What's going to happen? What will be happening to the capitals of the two classes of businessmen? Yes, Mr. Taylor.
Well, imagine that the one who is the one who is saving and investing 50% of that profit, yeah, their capital is going to grow.
Okay.
The other one is It's not because they're spending all their capital for the human growth.
Okay, so what happens if you have, if you're making a 10% profit and you save and reinvest half of it, what's that do to your initial capital?
It grows by
5%, right? And now, on the other hand, if you're consuming 15% and you have only a 10% rate of profit, what happens to your capital? It declines by 5%. So notice those who are saving and investing the most while investing with the same degree of efficiency, their capitals grow. Those who are consuming above the net consumption rate, their capitals decline. Now, as this proceeds, we have more and more capital gravitating into the hands of those businessmen and capitalists who save the most and consume the least. And capital is leaving the hands of those who consume excessively. So where is all the capital tending to gravitate as far as they invest with the same degree of skill and efficiency? Yeah, the capital is moving into the hands of those businessmen and capitalists who save the most and consume the least. Now, what does this itself mean about the economy-wide rate of net consumption? If more and more of the capital is gravitating into the hands of those with a 5% rate and leaving the hands of those with a 15% rate, where should all the capital end up? In the hands of those with a 5% net consumption rate, and what should the economy-wide net consumption rate end up being?
5%.
Well, there's a wider, we could obviously change the numbers, start with a 5% rate of profit, and some have a net consumption rate of 2%, others 7%, always. The tendency is for the rate of net consumption to be governed in the long run by the rates of consumption of those businessmen and capitalists who save the most and consume the least, who are the most future-oriented. The capital is always gravitating toward them. Out of any given rate of profit, they'll be saving and investing more heavily. They won't consume all of the profit. There are others consuming more than the profit. The one category grows, the other declines. So this is one major principle determining the gravitation, as I call it, of relative wealth and also income. It's tending to go into the hands of those who save and invest most heavily and out of the hands of those who consume most heavily. But then there's a second closely related principle. We've assumed for the last few minutes that all the businessmen and capitalists are investing with the same degree of skill and efficiency. Well, that's obviously not true. Some will invest more skillfully than others, and they'll earn higher rates of profit. Well, suppose we have two sets of businessmen, one of whom can invest and earn a higher rate of profit than the other. Let's say while the overall economy-wide average is 5%, there are some businessmen who are earning 10%, others who are earning nothing. Okay, if they had the same personal rates of net consumption, if they were all consuming at the rate of 5%, let's say, what's happening to the capital of those who invest more wisely and who are earning a rate higher than the net consumption rate? Who are earning 10%. But their capital is increasing, and what's happening to the capital of those who can't earn as much as the net consumption rate and who are consuming at the net consumption rate? Their capital declines. So we have really two principles of the gravitation of relative wealth and income. It's moving into the hands of those who save the most and consume the least, relatively speaking, and into the hands of those who invest most efficiently. I think these are two happy outcomes. It indicates, pardon me?
That's why the rich get richer.
Well, you're saying that's why the rich get richer. I think it's indicating that the people who will play the most prominent role in the economy are those who save and invest most heavily and who earn profits most skillfully. And now you could ask, well, does that signify anything for the rest of the population? Is this just the rich getting richer? Which is better from the point of view of the general population? Having businessmen and capitalists who save more and consume less, or do the opposite? Who save more and consume less? Because what will that mean about the ratio of wage payments to total consumption? what will that mean about the extent to which wages are paid relative to net consumption and thus higher. To total consumption?
More wages will be paid.
Wages will be higher. And what will be implied about wages relative to profits? They'll tend to be higher to the extent that a lower net consumption rate means a lower rate of profit, then the wages are higher relative to profits. And what will be true of the rate of capital accumulation and the rise in the standard of living and in real wages?
Increases.
So they'll go up.
They'll be going up. So this is something that is enabling everybody to get richer. And this is the general interest, and things work out for the best under these conditions. You know, we're used to hearing one thing after another wrong with the economy. Well, I think these principles are things that are very important that are right with the economy. Yes?
However, in your example you just gave, the businessmen, the capitalists who save and invest, certainly they continue to prosper. But isn't it true that the businessmen or simple employees who do not save and invest,
yeah.
You just made it, they're not going to prosper. You just mentioned that it makes it better for everyone.
Well, it
doesn't.
I'm
saying they're doing the right thing. I think they're doing the wrong thing, but they're not going to prosper.
Well, yes, they do prosper. Let's suppose we look at people here in the United States or any modern country, and we assume that they don't own any significant capital at all. Or if they do, it's not the major part of their lives. The average person is in a position to benefit profoundly from the capital of other people in a market economy. Let's say I don't own a single share of General Motors stock. I don't have any of their securities or any other automobile company. In what way do I benefit from the capital of those firms that I have no interest in financially?
The product they create.
Pardon me?
The product that they create.
Okay, I get the benefit of their capital when I buy their products.
Right.
Now, also I get the benefit of their capital when I sell my labor. So you just think the demand for labor depends on capital and the supply of products depend on capital. So the capital of other people is the foundation of the demand for the labor of the non-owners and the basis of the supply of the products of the non-owners. So contrary to popular impression, it's not true that to benefit from the means of production, you yourself need to be an owner. We all have a huge benefit from the means of production owned by other people in a market economy. See, it's different if we had an economy of self-sufficient farmers. If we were in an economy of self-sufficient farmers, and you look at some farmer's field or his animals or whatever, and you ask, who benefits from those things? Well, the farmer and his family benefit. They're producing for his consumption. But if you look at means of production in a market economy, what are the means of production used for? They're producing for the market. And who gets the benefit of those means of production via the products? It's the general consuming public. This is, I think, a profoundly important point. It means you don't have to first own the means of production to get their benefit. Most thinking and public discussion that goes on concerning this subject is ignorant of these simple points. For example, why do people think they have something to gain from the redistribution of wealth? See, as they say things,
if you take from the very wealthy, they'll end up getting more.
Yeah, we see that would not be such an unreasonable point of view if you were living in an economy of self-sufficient farmers. The only way you could benefit from the farmer's field would be if and when you got to be the owner. But do we need to become the owners of the means of production to benefit from them?
No.
As a matter of fact, what would happen if we socialized the economy? Then we would all have the privilege of being an equal 1/384,000,000th owner of the means of production. And what benefit would you derive from that? You already have the benefit of the means of production, and the means of production are operated under the incentive of profit and loss and with a freedom of competition. So what's happening to the magnitude of the goods available for the non-owners to buy? It's progressively improving. And talking about the public having an interest in the efficiency of businessmen, what is the way that an individual firm succeeds in boosting its profits? They can't do it by boosting the rate of net consumption. They have to be innovative. They have to introduce some better product or a more efficient method of producing an existing product. That's how they make a premium profit. What's the effect of that on the public? They get the better product or the more efficient method. And then what happens when competitors become aware that here's a firm with a premium profit and maybe their profits are lower because it's taking their customers away? What must they do as soon as they can?
Duplicate.
And when that happens, when the general standard of the industry incorporates the improvements, can any premium profit be made from it?
Down.
No. So what do you have to do at that point to go on making a premium profit?
Innovation.
Have further innovation with the same result. And what's the effect on the general standard of living as time goes on? It continually rises. So the non-owners have not only the benefit, but a growing benefit. And then, of course, it's possible that everyone, to some degree, could also be an owner, not a great owner, but an owner sufficient to provide for illness and retirement. Yes, Mr. Foster.
I don't want to over-exaggerate this, but yeah. My imagination with what you're saying, the non-owners can reap benefits.
Yeah.
I can liken this to the butterfly effect. Now, are we stating that just regular consumers with their contributions to the economy will positively affect others who are non-owners? Or are we just specifically stating businessmen and capitalists, their contributions?
It's the contribution of businessmen and capitalists.
Okay.
The average person does not benefit to any great degree from other average people, unfortunately.
Okay.
But he does benefit from the activities of the innovators very profoundly. Okay. Now, I have a reference here to net consumption, its other sources, a wider meaning, relationship to the saving of wage earners. There are some other possible sources of net consumption, but they wouldn't be permanent sources. For example, suppose you have a corporation which buys back some of its shares. It's putting some of its funds into the hands of shareholders. Now, what will those shareholders be doing probably with most of the funds they receive?
Consuming. Spending.
Well, I think they'll buy other shares. They might consume some of it, but they'll buy other shares. The sellers of those other shares, they may consume some, but they'll buy still other shares. In this way, what's happening to funds that originate within corporations? Funds are getting dispersed to the wider economy, and in that way can be a source of net consumption. To the extent that business firms grant consumer credit, that can be a source of net consumption. So these are some further ways. Now, I have a reference to the wider meaning of net consumption. We can think of net consumption in a number of related different ways in terms of simple equations. Let's hope this will bring up the right link. Ah, doesn't exist. I didn't update that link. All right. Let's see if we can get to it this way. Okay, here we are. When I introduced net consumption, I said it's consumption over and above wage payments. I hope this can be seen in the back. I guess I can enlarge it and we're just concentrating on this side. In terms of the notation we used in deriving the equality of national income with net national product, do you recall that derivation a couple of weeks back? All right, S sub C stands for business sales revenues constituted by consumption expenditure. W sub B is that part of wages that are part of productive expenditure paid by business. Well, net consumption is the excess of total consumption, total demand for consumers' goods from business over and above the wages paid by business. That's net consumption. And you can see it back in the table we were looking at. I'll have to get back to that. All right, let me try to find that table. Here we are. Okay, notice net consumption is 200 here, right? What's total consumption? What's S sub C? Pardon me? All right, Ms. Yang says 500. Does anyone have a different answer?
It's demand for labor minus 500 minus demand for labor.
The total consumption, S sub C, is 500. It's the sum of labor's demand for consumers' goods, that's 300, and the businessman and capitalist, that's 200. So the total demand for consumers' goods is 500. And if we subtract from that, the demand for labor by business, well, it's this 500 minus that 300. That's the 200 of net consumption. What allows S sub C to be greater than WB is the consumption of the businessmen and capitalists. But net consumption is that excess of consumption over wage payments. Okay, now, also, though, net consumption can be expressed as the difference between total sales revenues, total sales revenues and productive expenditure. Unfortunately, I don't have that shown here. All right, here we have it. If we have S sub C and S sub B together, that's sales revenues. S sub C plus S sub B taken together, that's total sales revenues. What is W sub B and S sub B taken together?
Wages.
Yes? Productive expenditure. W sub B and S sub B together is productive expenditure. What do you get if you subtract these two terms taken together from these two taken together? If you subtract the second two from the first two. Well, what do you get if you subtract SB from SB?
Zero.
Zero. So what are we left with? We have SC minus WB. So net consumption can also be expressed as sales revenues minus productive expenditure. It's two equivalent ways to express it. It's the demand for consumers' goods from business minus the wages paid by business. It's also sales revenues minus productive expenditure. They're equivalent, unless the only difference is the demand for capital goods. And then also, finally, net consumption can be stated as equal to total consumption minus total wages. Total consumption minus total wages.
What page is that?
This page here. This is 725. Okay, now I think I also had something. I had this further formulation. If we add to S sub C, W sub C, the wages paid by consumers, and if we add W sub B and W sub C, we have total wages. So net consumption is also equal to total consumption minus total wages. Three different ways to express the same idea. The basic formulation is the demand for the products of business minus the demand for labor by business, SC minus SB. SC minus WB, SC minus WB. Thank you. Okay, a last significant point here, I refer to it as confirming the critique of the exploitation theory. The exploitation theory is the leading doctrine of Karl Marx. It's an inspiration for the attitudes of many labor unions. It's the claim that the original primary producers are manual workers. It goes back all the way to Adam Smith. It was really originated by Adam Smith before Marx got hold of it. And Adam Smith, I put it here in right here. Adam Smith and Karl Marx postulated a simple state of affairs in which manual workers produced and sold products, kept the whole sales proceeds, and did not act as capitalists. They did not buy for the sake of subsequently selling. That was their assumption. Marx called this simple circulation. He described it as CMC. Workers produce a commodity C, they sell it for money M, and they turn around and consume the proceeds. No capitalistic expenditure, no productive expenditure, no buying for the sake of selling. Now, Smith and Marx believed that in these circumstances of manual workers just producing and selling products, not acting as capitalists, they thought that all income was wages and no income was profits. And they held that profit came into existence only later on with the development of what Marx called capitalistic circulation, buying for the sake of selling. This was the sequence MCM prime, M being an outlay of money to produce a commodity C to be sold for a larger sum of money, M prime. It's what I call productive expenditure. And they held that when profit did come into existence, profits were a deduction from what was originally, naturally, and rightfully all wages. They argued, here we are, originally, we have manual workers producing and selling products. That they called wages. The workers keep the whole proceeds. A labor is getting the full value of its product. But then later on, capitalists appear, and capitalist circulation, and the capitalists allegedly are now deducting profit as a chunk, a rake-off, from what originally, naturally, and rightfully was all wages. All right, well, I ask you in this paragraph to determine what the effect on the rate of profit would be if there were no capitalists, but just sellers of products. You're given the following information, which will test their propositions, Smith and Marx's propositions, in the light of the net consumption theory. So here we are, we have receipts from the sale of products, are 1,000, but all of which is consumed by the sellers. The sellers take their whole 1,000 of receipts, they don't spend a dime of it on productive expenditure, they consume it all, and that constitutes a fresh 1,000 of sales receipts in the next period. Okay, now we're asking you, what is the amount of productive expenditure present?
Zero.
There is no productive expenditure. All right, what is the amount of wages paid in the production of products? And let me make this point.
Zero.
Pardon me?
Zero.
It is zero. Now you see, if in fact you go and you buy a pair of shoes from someone, let's say we have a cobbler, he's producing a pair of shoes, and you buy the pair of shoes he produces, are you paying him a wage?
Wages is a profit.
You're buying his product, you're paying him a sales revenue. Now, but because he has not acted capitalistically, he hasn't spent any money in order to bring in his sales revenues, will he have any money costs? That's the next question. State the amount of money outlays to be deducted as sales revenues from costs.
Material costs.
Well, yes? Ms. Yang is saying there is none. And why do you say there is none?
There's no sales revenue. You cannot deduct anything as a cost,
as expense.
There's no productive expenditure.
There's no productive expenditure, so where do costs come from? Let's look at it this way. Suppose we go through a different set of sequences. Initially, I tell you, someone spends $900 to bring in $1,000. What's his cost of bringing in the $1,000?
Money.
900. Okay. Suppose he only had to spend 90 to bring in the 1,000. What's his cost of bringing in the 1,000?
90.
Suppose he only had to spend 9.
9.
90.9.
90.9.
0.
Zero.
Zero. Okay, well, that's the situation here. If you don't have capitalistic circulation, if you don't have people laying out money for the sake of bringing in money, if you don't have productive expenditure, you don't have costs. And if that were the condition of these manual workers in simple circulation, which is what we're told it was, then they have 1,000 of sales revenues, but what cost do they have? None. So how much profit is earned here if you have 1,000 of sales and no costs? The whole sales revenues are profit, not wages. And there'd be no nominal capital in existence, so the rate of profit would actually be infinite. You'd have 1,000 of profit divided by 0 of capital, that's infinite. Now, this is significant, I think, because what it means is that the original primary form of income, if we had manual workers producing and selling products, but not acting capitalistically, even though the only people who are getting any income are manual workers, what would be the accounting nature of the income they'd be getting? Would it be wages or profits? It would be profits. They'd be having sales revenues. They're not getting wages. When you buy someone's product, it's not paying him a wage. He has sales revenues. And if no one is acting capitalistically, there's no cost. The whole income is profit. So the point is, the original income that Smith and Marx were claiming was wages, and which capitalists later deducted profits from, it's not true. The original income is profit. It's a labor income, but it's profit. It's made as profit. And then what is the effect when capitalists appear and they start making productive expenditures? What phenomena does that give rise to which did not previously exist? Pardon me?
Wage costs.
It will give rise to wages. It gives rise to productive expenditure, which includes wage payments, and gives rise to costs, with what effect on the part of sales revenues that remains as profit?
Less.
It'll be less. The more economically capitalistic the economy, in the sense of the more the buying for the sake of selling relative to the sales, the lower is the proportion of sales that is profit, the higher the proportion that's wages. So it's actually the opposite of what Marx and Smith had in mind. It's not the case that capitalists come and deduct profits from wages. They're creating wages along with other costs, which are a deduction from sales revenues, which serves to reduce the proportion of sales revenues that's profit. So I think this is a very significant implication that they had it backwards. Okay, well, on that note, I think we can leave further matters to next week. There'll be more to say about the theory and its application. And then in the last week, we'll deal with the subject of inflation. So I know this has been a little bit involved tonight, but that's the nature of the beast. So see you next week.